Hello and a very warm welcome to Monocle on Design. It's the show dedicated to the best in architecture, industrial design, graphics and fashion. I'm Josh Bennett. Coming up today.
What had happened was that record labels treated this new format as sort of the little garbage bin. Like, you know, the reissues would basically, they would just take the old album cover, shrink it down to from 12-inch to this 5-inch thing, and put it in a plastic box and call it a day.
We cast our minds back to one of our favourite interviews of the past year with none other than the Austrian graphic design maestro, Stefan Sagmeister. Plus, later, I'll be joined in studio by Monocle's design editor, Nolan Giles, to talk about how design can profoundly impact quality of life for the better. All that coming up right here on Monocle on Design on Monocle 24. Do stay tuned. Now, back in March, we visited the New York-based graphic designer Stefan Sagmeister. His studio, Sagmeister & Walsh, has completed works from head-turning covers for the New York Times magazine, playful ads for New York retailer Barney's, car firm Kia, and the energy provider EDP, to name just a few. Not to mention his envelope-pushing use of typography. Monocle's regular contributor, Henry Rhys Sheridan, spoke to Sagmeister about growing up in Austria, his big break in album art, and why taking sabbaticals is so important.
Well, I grew up in a small town called Bregenz in the very, very western part of Austria, very close to the border of Switzerland and Germany, 5 miles from each border. It's a pretty small town, 25,000 people on a lake within the mountains with a very substantial cultural offering. There is a big music festival there on the lake. So it's a good place to grow up. I am the youngest of 6 kids, 3 boys and 3 girls, and we grew up above a store. My parents had a clothing store that, you know, was sort of the big clothing store in the small town. And growing up, I hated being above the store because you always had to wait. You could never just talk to mom and dad. You always had to wait until they were done, you know, with some client or with somebody who bought something. And of course, most dinner and lunch conversations somehow evolved around the store. I think my dad was forced by his dad to take over the store, and his dad was forced by his dad to take over the store. So I think by the time, considering both of my brothers went into the store, I could pretty much choose whatever I wanted. And I knew fairly early on, I would say roughly at 15, that I wanted to do something with design because I had started to write for a magazine, and it turned out that I actually enjoyed doing the layout for that magazine much better than the writing.
So this magazine was Alporn, is that correct?
You know everything.
And my understanding is that it was a kind of left-wing, youth-oriented, yes, Austrian magazine. Tell me a little bit more about it. Who was it aimed at, and how did you end up working on it at the age of 15, 16?
Well, it was a young people's magazine, mostly run by high schoolers and some students. It had the proud print run of 1,000. We sometimes got it printed, but we also had a printing machine, so sometimes we attempted to print it ourselves, but we were terrible printers, so it looked better when we didn't print it ourselves. And it was, I think the subtitle was called The Magazine for the Provinces, sort of like for the rural, or for a rural space, that sort of thing. But the magazine was also quite culturally active, as in, you know, organized anything from demonstrations to festivals to concerts and things. And all of these things required a steady flow of some sort of graphic items, which, considering I was already doing the layout, I also did and sort of like learned about the process of design, but also about, very importantly, about its function. Like, I found it endlessly fascinating that you could, you know, design a poster, put that up, and 1,000 people would show up on a festival, pretty much because there was no other media available, pretty much on account of that poster. And that I found a wonderful line of work to pursue. Then moving to Vienna soon after high school graduation, and applying to the University for Applied Arts, where I promptly did not make the entry exam, and I went for a year into sort of like a smaller art school and basically trained myself in that year to retake that entry exam, and then the second time it worked.
Tell me about your kind of formal design education in some more detail. What was the course like when you got onto it? What did it involve, and did you enjoy yourself?
Well, the University for Applied Arts definitely was the most prestigious sort of like design school in Austria. I think it still is. And they have a number of countries in Central Europe. I think Germany has it as well. Or I know that Germany has it as well, sort of a masterclass system, meaning that you basically apply with one professor and then you stick with that same professor throughout the 4 years. In my case, the professor was Paul Schwartz, who was an accomplished and I think fairly prominent designer in the 1950s. There was an opportunity in Vienna that four students from the Schwartz class, we convinced the director of the Schauspielhaus, which at the time was definitely the most prominent big new theater in Vienna, sort of like the theater that would play contemporary plays, that we would do their posters. And so every 6 weeks or one or so, we showed new posters for the new play to that theater director, and he basically chose one of us. And so this was an incredible opportunity because those posters would be hanging all over Vienna. And we, of course, had a chance to be part of the rehearsals, talk to the directors, talk to the actors, talk to the writers, meet incredible people, but also then again see that these things actually make a difference. And so while I think that probably was as important as going to school.
After graduating, Stefan worked in Hong Kong before taking a job in New York with his design hero, Tibor Kalman. Soon after, he set up his own studio focused on music design.
Well, I was quite glad to open up my own thing, and the idea to start something small and the idea to start something that would literally be concentrating on things for the music industry seemed incredibly delightful to me, because doing album covers was something that I had wanted when I was 15, but then kind of lost track on, or because there were so many other things that were possible in design. And the possibility to really concentrate on that, by that point I was 30 or so, seemed the kind of thing that generated a warm feeling in my belly when I thought about it. So that was it.
I'm absolutely fascinated by the work that your firm initially did, or at least your approach to the work in music, because this was during a time where the main medium through which music was distributed was the CD. And I am kind of at the very end of the last generation of people for whom the CD was still the most, you know, the thing. That's how I got my music when I was younger. And my memories of CDs when I was younger, I thought there were some CDs with some kind of fantastic design features. But it seems to have been completely overlooked as a design object, and indeed kind of denigrated in comparison to the vinyl, of course, but also even the cassette tape, which has made a kind of a comeback in a way that I can't see the CD doing.
Exactly like you say, like, you know, in 93 when we opened the studio, the medium was the CD. What had happened was that record labels treated this new format as sort of the little garbage bin, like, you know, the reissues would basically, they would just take the old album cover, shrink it down from 12-inch to this 5-inch thing and put it in a plastic box and call it a day. Now, of course, that didn't work. And of course, that looked crappy. And of course, a lot of people were very disappointed by this. And a lot of designers were very disappointed by this. I felt that while the CD definitely had some serious disadvantages, mainly that it came in a ugly plastic box, the jewel case, and two, that it had a smaller format, it also offered some serious advantages. mainly that it basically came already with a minimum of an 8-page booklet, but you could easily, it was so cheap to do a 16-page or a 24-page that it wasn't very difficult to talk a record label into doing that. And from that point of view, because you also had a front cover, a back cover, an inside cover, a CD label to do, there were very different storytelling opportunities. So while you definitely lost something quite a bit on the format, there were other things that you could exploit. And I think we took that quite seriously and tried to really then have a much more serious story going on, or you just had so many, many more panels, you had so many more possibilities. Whenever possible, we tried to circumvent the plastic jewel case by working with some sort of cardboard case. That, of course, was much, much, much more trickier because there was a price jump there. The cheapest, easiest way from a record label point of view was a 8-page booklet, 4 colors on one side, 1 color on the inside, a 1-color label, and you always had to fight against that cheapest kind of thing. But whenever we could, and you know, a good number of times we managed to convince them, we went to a more cardboard label, which had, I think, as its main, the cardboard pack or the digipack, which was sort of like a mixture between cardboard and plastic. They just aged much better. The problem of the plastic jewel case was mostly one of aging. That, you know, one of the lovely things about packaging music was that the packaging was very, very much part of the product, and it was not thrown away as one of the few packages. The vinyl cover wasn't thrown away, but also the CD cover really wasn't thrown away. So with that, it of course needed longevity that really played a role. And we tried to give that a pleasant longevity as good as we could.
When you look back on some of those CD designs now, what ones stand out for you?
I think we did some good job on Lou Reed. I mean, definitely set the Twilight Wheeling in that sort of like very dark blue colored plastic box, I think came out really well. I think some of the work we did for David Byrne, both his solo work but also his duo work together with Brian Eno, I think worked well. And I mean, we're definitely, I would say that the status of the studio changed simply because we managed to do a cover for the Stones. It's not one of my favorite covers, but I think that many jobs we got later had something to do with the fact, oh, they also, like the Stones, came to them.
Every 7 years, Stefan takes a sabbatical when he shuts down his studio for an entire year to explore ideas without the pressure of deadlines and client expectations.
Well, I've done 3. So from a date perspective, one was in the 2000, one was 2008, one was 2015. And all was a year. The first one was in New York. That it was, I couldn't really think of also going somewhere else. It was so new and at the time also so scary that just doing it in New York was enough. The second one was in Indonesia. The third one was on 3 places, Mexico City, Tokyo, and a tiny village in the Austrian Alps. And they all 3, I think by design, had a different flavor because I didn't want to fall into the trap of repeating the kind of sabbaticals the kind it did. So the first one was very much non-producing, as in the year was pretty much spent thinking about things, catching stuff out, but not really executing them. So I wound up in the first one, I wound up basically with a big sketchbook. The second one in Indonesia was much more producing. I had people, designers working with me in Indonesia. We just didn't work on any client-related stuff. We started the film there. Also, the ideas for the show about happiness was laid there, but we also created things like this table that we have in front of us, or this chair, or there was a whole bunch of furniture that came out of it. And it was quite productive in that we actually executed things. I mean, there were containers and containers of things that came out of Indonesia that were sent here. If I look back now and sort of think about the projects that are close to my heart, what we creating the studio, let's say, like that whole series of things I've learned in my life so far, or the happy film, or the exhibition on beauty, things that I find meaningful that we've done them. They all have one thing in common, that they found their initiation in one of the sabbaticals. So in many ways, I found them incredibly helpful.
You mentioned two specific ideas that came out of the two most recent sabbaticals. And the latest one produced a project in collaboration with your partner, Jessica Walsh, on beauty. Now, happiness and beauty are both quite unfashionable concepts within the world of design. Were you conscious of that when you set out to explore them? And did you find that attractive about them?
I would say that definitely would be the case for beauty. Like, you know, meaning I've lived now for 30 years in the design world, and I'm extremely aware of the fact that most designers hate talking about beauty or hate talking about aesthetics in general. It's just not something that's on the forefront of most people. Like, you know, most people, specifically, let's say, in my profession of communication design, would describe themselves as all sorts of things, like, you know, problem solvers, storytellers, whatnot, but they definitely wouldn't see themselves as somebody who are engaged in beauty. It's a controversial subject, which is sort of crazy, considering it was at the forefront of almost all of production for most of human history.
Sorry, what do you think happened? Why was the concept of beauty kind of dropped from within mainstream design culture?
Well, I think what had happened was a misunderstanding of the early 20th century avant-garde that sometimes very explicitly, sometimes less so, went into a direction of simplicity and function, but took form very, very seriously still. If you look at the beginning of modernism, you know, specifically, let's say, Adolf Loos or even Mies or Corbusier, form played an incredibly big role there. And then some of these ideas of the early avant-garde were misunderstood by the second or third generation after that, specifically after, in the second half of 20th century, as a economic functionalism that really brought this, you know, psychotic sameness that we suffer from today. We made a mistake. Beauty has to be put back in on the same level as function, otherwise we will not create good work. You can see that everywhere, across the board, be it architecture, be it city planning, be it interfaces. This is basically repeated time after time again. And I think even, let's say, if you don't really care about humanity and you say, well, ultimately, I'm just interested in function. Who gives a shit if people feel good doing that or not? Even if that is your stance, you still will not get around beauty, because beauty makes things function much, much better.
And what do you have in store for the rest of your career? What do you want to achieve? What do you hope to achieve? How many sabbaticals do you have left?
Well, I mean, you know, ultimately, of course, I can do whatever I want. So I could also go on, you know, on a sabbatical next year if I wanted to. So it's not like that I'm absolutely bound by this seven-year rhythm. It just basically was that the seven-year rhythm so far has worked best for me. And I would say that I myself ultimately have right now less interest in the commercial world, not because I find that not interesting or not worthwhile of my time. It's just that I've done a lot in that world and I'm probably more stronger. My attraction to self-generated projects in that vein of, let's say, a project on beauty, or could also be things that might be smaller than that, is definitely bigger.
That was our interview with New York-based graphic designer Stefan Sagmeister. He was speaking to Monocle's Henry Rhys Sheridan back in March. Well, I'm delighted to say that I'm joined now in studio by Monocle's one, Monocle's only design editor, Nolan Giles, and we're here to crack the spine of the latest issue of Monocle magazine, themed, as you'll know already, around the idea of quality of life. Now, Nolan, we have this handsome beast of a July-August edition of Monocle in front of us. Why is design important to quality of life, do you think? And why do we set ourselves the task of fulfilling this very big issue of the magazine for people to take away on holiday with them each summer?
Yeah, there's plenty of aspects of design that feed into this idea of quality of life. But I think the most important comes down to urban design and the way that we think about our cities. This is obviously a combination between architects, urban planners, and the governments themselves. And I think that what we show, particularly in the design section, but also in the affairs section of the magazine, is that when these three kind of parties all come together in the urban sphere and create something for the people, then we can all live a little bit better in our city. So this is kind of what we've delved into in the design section for the quality of life issue, starting with parks.
Yeah, there's a bit of a sweet spot, isn't there, for allowing people room to enjoy space, for architects to not be too prescriptive, for governments to let the rules be lax enough to allow people to, I guess, enjoy public space as opposed to just kind of walking through it and saying, oh, isn't that beautiful, isn't that gorgeous? And you've hit on the theme of play, which I think is a good way of subverting it, because these spaces are designed to be enjoyed and the rules are made a little bit, I suppose, to be broken. Where do we find the best examples of play in the urban sphere?
Yeah, like you say, it's very important for the rules to be a little bit loose. And two European cities that do this very well are Amsterdam and Berlin. And we pick up in Berlin just for the fact that, I mean, if you look through the pages, it's obvious why we picked their parks to showcase, because
yeah, they're kind of a weird wooden head swelling from the ground in a Berlin park, and I'm going to call it the carcass of a whale.
We've got a giant whale in a park in the centre of Berlin, and looking at it, you can see that these kids are they're up the top there in many countries where parks are kind of specced out, commissioned by city governments. They tend to have the same swings, the same slides. Everything's built super safe. But in Berlin, for what they call the Spielplatz, which is the playground, they've just injected this whole other level of creativity, and it's become a culture there of designing these far-out, completely wacky parks that kids can interpret in whichever way they want. So, you know, we can climb up the whale if we want to climb up it. We can hide under it and make a den out of it. There's a big slide coming out of its rear, or a pole coming out of its rear, which you can kind of climb up or slide down. And for kids, I mean, obviously this teaches them creativity. It teaches them to think about things a little bit more in a bit more of a broad-minded sense. They're not kind of driven to do one thing. And for people walking by, it's a nice thing to look at as well.
And we do talk about rules. In the front of the magazine, there's a bit of an urban manifesto for how you live in the city. But do you think it's important for design to create spaces that don't just prescribe exactly how you should behave in them? Is that a way that we should be thinking more about building in our cities?
Yeah, definitely. And the examples of Berlin and Amsterdam both look at cities that were kind of bombed out during the Second World War. And there was very different approaches. While the Spielplatz kind of rose up in Berlin, I think in Amsterdam, this idea of play and about designers creating things that give a lot of options and aren't prescribing one particular way of play was really pronounced. There was a guy there called Aldo van Eyck, and you probably recognize some of his designs in play parks the world over, the igloo that can either be for climbing on or can be for hiding under. And the other thing that's interesting with Amsterdam is the fact that they have this idea about learning through doing rather than, you know, rules enforcing fear. For example, one of the architects I spoke to as part of this story was saying, you know, you can either do two things if you have a lake in a park. You can put a fence around it, or you can just make sure that children are taught to swim when they're young. It's just a very practically minded way of not kind of mollycoddling children and teaching them to be a bit more practical at a young age.
I love it. What a great little lesson that is. And if we spin the globe, Nolan, of all the best looking and finest design stories in the world, where would we end up next after parks?
Well, we'd probably end up in Murano in South Tyrol.
I've never heard of it. Where is that?
It's a Monocle favourite. If you're a Monocle reader, you definitely know where Murano in South Tyrol is. But if you're not, then it's basically south of the Austrian and German borders, in the north of Italy. It's a German-speaking semi-autonomous state where craftsmanship is high on the agenda when it comes to architecture, and we are looking at a residence that we produced for the magazine on such a beautiful house.
Yeah, amazing kind of mid-century house that's obviously been taken over by the residents. And you can imagine sort of two worlds being lived, or two lives being lived there. You have the Dolomites in the background, the snow-topped tips of a beautiful kind of mountaintop. You could also maybe imagine a kind of peacock on the lawn and this kind of like beautiful Italian finery to the place. Extremely tasteful. What a wonderful find. What else do we look for in the quality of life issue, Nolan? As the design editor, what else makes up a good section?
Well, sometimes it's a city that isn't quite there yet in terms of quality of life, but a city that is making the effort to get there. And that is very much the goal of the mayor of Haifa in Israel. This city is known for its port. It's a very industrial place, but it's also, you know, on the coast. It's a beautiful location, has an incredible climate. And, you know, there's lots of money there and opportunity. And this mayor, who studied in Europe as an architect, has taken it upon herself to really push her ideas of what makes a livable city and a well-designed city into government and across the city. So we're seeing improvements in public transport. We're seeing the university's architecture kind of being put to the front in terms of what other architects in the city could be benchmarking. Part of the reason for that is because Oscar Niemeyer did many parts of the design for that university. So she's taking a design-led approach to beautifying the city, and it seems to be working out well for her, as we can see through these beautiful photos.
And that's a rather beautiful report in a rather sun-kissed part of Israel. Nolan, I want to draw your attention now to the briefings pages, some of the shorter, snappier stories, where someone appears to have defaced the column by drawing a frankly terrible version of you in the top right-hand corner.
I've been dealing with that picture for 3 years now.
It's an insult, but I rather like it. You've written a column about scooters, and scooters are an interesting thing when we talk about transport in cities, because they engage in two different parts of the debate. They're a last-mile mobility solution for getting around. They also require a bit of etiquette that you don't leave it in someone else's path where they're going to fall over it or chuck it in a river after you've finished using it. You had a bit of a... Is moan the right word for it? You had a bit of a...
I had a whinge.
You had a bit of a whinge.
A proper whinge. And also because Paris, when you look at the changes that are happening in that city, it's very progressive. The mayor there, she's enforcing all sorts of incredible initiatives, one being just to make sure all of the new buildings are white because it reflects the sun and it's much better for the planet and it cools down the whole city. She's also enabling huge parks to be created there, lots of green space being added to what is a very dense city. And then flying in the face of that, you have these international companies coming in with these electric scooters, and basically the whole thing isn't being regulated. I've written here that there's about 15,000, this was written about 2 months ago, and there's probably about 30,000 now, of these brightly coloured mobility devices weaving around the city on people who have no understanding of how to use them, because they are quite a new technology. They don't know if you should ride them on the pavement, if you should ride them on the road. They're just basically causing chaos, and then when the riders are done with them, they discard them on the street. And obviously this doesn't do much to help the image of Paris, which is typically seen as quite a beautiful place.
Well, I think Midori House is quite a beautiful place, but I've seen your bike parked outside, left all over the place. Is it fair that you're having a go at these scooter riders when very clearly you're a terrible cyclist?
Well, I am a terrible cyclist, and I do happen to leave my bike in some places where people maybe don't like them to be left. It's the people that are regulating them, the government and also the companies themselves, that should take a little bit more responsibility in terms of, I guess, rider education, in terms of telling people where these things can be left, and also the government, you know, designating areas for them to be left, like we have our beautiful bike parking space in Monaco. If people choose to break the rules, they get told off on radio. If they don't, you know, everyone's happy.
That's very true. And I'm just going to press you with one more question before you dash upstairs, Nolan. We've applied the finishing crosses to the T's and dots to the I's of the September issue as we're talking. Would you give us one little story to kind of tempt us to buying the next issue or to subscribing or to looking ahead? What can we expect from September?
Well, have you ever been to Darmstadt before, Josh?
Where is Darmstadt?
It's south of Frankfurt. It's in Germany, and it has one of the most beautiful offices I've ever encountered in my life. And it's also a completely sustainably minded building. So I'm not going to talk about the company itself. Everything about the architecture is designed with the planet in mind, from earth brick walls to incredible well-glazed windows that let in so much natural light that actually staff in the building are encouraged to sit in the middle of an office, which is totally bizarre when you think about most offices. You want to be by the window. Here, people are actually drawn into the architecture, into the most light-filled spaces. Just so many clever design devices going on to really improve the way that people work. And that is the theme of the issue, Josh, the way to work.
And sadly, that's all we have time for on today's show. But don't forget, if you need a little more design-minded inspiration, you can subscribe to this show and our sister podcast, the Natalie named On Design Extra. It's available each Thursday. You could also pick up a copy of the latest issue of Monocle magazine, the July-August issue, no less, which is available on all self-respecting newsstands now. Monocle on Design was produced by Daphne Karnesis and Tom Hall this week. It was edited today by Sam Howard. I'm Josh Fennett. Thank you very much for listening, and goodbye.